This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
Let these decisions remain between parents, children, and their doctors. If rules must be adopted, then please adopt the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Standards of Care.
Gender-affirming care for minors is under attack in Florida.
We had been running an active picket line, and we had been charged by several managers before this. So the executive vice president for the local actually charged his car into the line, you know, revved right up to it, and came within a few inches of one of our members.
Pacific Northwest Staff Union SEIU 2015 strikers face auto assaults by union management.
Poor profiteering is obscene!
Turn around and make something green!
And activists stage a people's tribunal charging U.S. weapons makers with war crimes. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. The Florida Board of Medicine, whose members include donors to Governor Ron DeSantis' re-election campaign, has moved to stop gender-affirming care for minors. Basil Pursley, a Pacifica affiliate WSLR 96.5 in Sarasota, Florida, filed this report.
On October 28th, the Florida Board of Medicine, along with a panel of subject experts, met to discuss the rules on gender-affirming care procedures. The board approved a motion to prohibit therapies such as puberty blockers, cross-hormonal therapies, and surgeries under gender-affirming care to treat gender dysphoria to anyone under the age of 18. This decision has been met with uproar from the trans community and their allies, some even going as far to call this a deliberate genocide on trans youth. Several members of the Board of Medicine have made significant financial donations to Governor Ron DeSantis' re-election campaign. The board had a panel of several experts to help inform their decision on gender-affirming care. These experts came in with clear positions on whether they were pro-gender-affirming care or anti. Notable anti-trans pediatric endocrinologist Michael K. Laidlaw was one of the few experts to show up in person. Laidlaw presented a PowerPoint to the board and the public detailing why he believed gender-affirming care for minors is ill-advised.
Gender dysphoria is a distress that arises from an incongruence between that identity and the physical body, leading to impairment. I think it's important to note that studies have shown that desistance or growing out of this condition of children by adulthood is very high, some 50 to 98%. And these are studies done primarily on 12 years old and younger.
Laidlaw cites a desistance rate of 50 to 98%, an incredibly wide margin for a presumably researched percentage. This statistic comes from Laidlaw's own published study in 2019, which has been criticized by the medical community for misrepresenting how the desistance or persistence of gender dysphoria functions. The current standard for early childhood gender dysphoria treatment practices, based on the watchful waiting Dutch approach, typically includes beginning puberty blockers as early as 12 and reevaluating as time goes on, usually until age 16, to determine if there has been persistence in the condition. Laidlaw goes on to state that there are no significant biomarkers indicating one's gender identity.
On what basis? Where can we find the gender identity to be certain that these children will not desist by adulthood? Can we use imaging of the brain or blood tests, genetic testing? Are there other biomarkers to ensure that we are correct? There is no such thing.
When questioned by members of the board, Laidlaw admitted that the studies he was referring to have been on adults who have transitioned, not minors, despite that being the age group under focus. It is worth noting that Dr. Laidlaw does not treat gender dysphoria in his practice. Dr. Meredith McNamara, a board-certified adolescent medicine physician and pediatrician and an assistant professor at the Yale School of Medicine, made a case for gender-affirming care.
I provide clinical care for youth age 12 to 25, which includes transgender and gender-expansive youth. I join you from Connecticut to address health policy matters in Florida because misinformation about gender-affirming care poses a threat to the well-being of youth everywhere, and the use of misinformation to set legal standards will degrade medical authority.
McNamara was asked by the board how likely it was that children who experienced gender dysphoria would grow out of the condition and how medical experts would be able to tell.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the prevailing themes of our all of our testimonies today is that it's highly individualized. These children and their families meet with therapists, with experts on gender dysphoria. A range of options to help this child live authentically and comfortably are offered. For pre-pubertal children, though, this does not include medications of any kind. And I really want to state that clearly. That is stated emphatically in clinical practice guidelines from WPATH and the Endocrine Society.
McNamara's testimony included citations of multiple reviewed medical studies that asserted the case for gender-affirming care, explaining that the current standard of medical care today typically does not include giving hormones to young children and instead consists of long, thoughtful process that is tailored to individual needs rather than a standard set of care that is given to every patient. Following testimony, DeSanta's appointed board member Nicholas Romanello proposed a motion.
Mr. Chair, I believe that based upon the testimony that we heard this morning and the materials in the portal, that the risk of puberty-suppressing therapies cross hormonal therapy and surgery, those risks outweigh the possible benefits and that there is a lack of consistent, reliable, scientific, peer-reviewed evidence concerning the efficacy and safety of such treatment. And with that in mind, for discussion purposes, I would propose a rule that would prohibit such therapies. And again, I'm talking about puberty blocking therapies such as GR, H, and I'll look to my colleagues to better define what that looks like, as well as kind of cross-hormonal therapies and surgery to treat gender-affirming care or gender dysphoria for patients under the chronological age of 18.
The motion was seconded. However, voting could not take place until some deliberation and public comment. The public comment section included 9 people who had previously transitioned but had then detransitioned, a parent who blamed gender-affirming care for his child's suicide, 5 pro-trans advocates, including many parents of trans children, and 6 testimonies from people in favor of the ruling. 1 trans person was permitted to speak.
Hi, I'm Jude Spiegel. I'm a transgender parent of 2 children, and I've known I was transgender since I was very young. I suffered from suicidal ideation from the age of 10 to 26 and attempted suicide multiple times, thinking it was wrong to be who I was. I wanted changes I didn't think I could ever have. I didn't feel safe opening up about who I was until later in life, but this isn't about me. Let these decisions remain between parents, children, and their doctors. If rules must be adopted, then please adopt the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Standards of Care.
Dr. Kevin Asiel, an assistant professor with the University of South Florida Tunisia College of Pharmacy, also spoke against the proposal.
When you graduated from medical school, you took an oath to do no harm. These decisions today will completely violate that oath. And I think upon that, your medical license should be reviewed and should be considered to be revoked if you pass this legislation. Thank you.
The board announced that they would only be taking 1 more public comment and referred additional public comments to be sent to an email address. This was met with audience members shouting, "The blood is on your hands."
Okay, that's right. Okay, Ms. Patty Sullivan, you may proceed. You may proceed.
The blood is on your hands.
That's okay.
State Representative Anna V. Escamani of Orlando asked to address the board on behalf of her constituents and was denied. The board moved to voting, approving the ban of any gender-affirming care to treat gender dysphoria to patients under 18, except board-reviewed university studies. Following this result, multiple families of trans children have spoken of their plans to flee the state. On December 4th, the board will reconvene and consider public comments and finally complete the ruling. For now, the future is uncertain for trans youth and their families across the state of Florida, as they fear their life-saving medicine may soon be revoked. This is Basil Persley reporting for WSLR.
For more on this story, we'll now hear from Tampa Bay community activist Harrison Lundy in conversation with Ali Abdelkader of WSLR's The Ruthless Truth.
Could you give our listeners a bit more info on what exactly the Florida Board of Medicine is and what they are going to be banning?
Yeah, so the Board of Medicine, at least in Florida, is kind of like a board of medical professionals that are actually appointed by the governor, who have met in recent months to talk about banning methods of gender affirming care to trans kids. So what had ended up happening was, you know, this is an unelected board. Actually, quite a few of these members had given money to the DeSantis campaign and to also his reelection campaign. And so what had happened was a couple weeks ago, they met in a committee to ban trans care. So gender affirming care, so puberty blockers, operational surgery, things of that nature. They met in a committee to do this. And so last Friday, after that passed, unfortunately, the Board of Medicine and the Board of Osteopathic Medicine met to put that motion basically into action. And so now what's going to happen is they're going to take, I believe, the next few weeks to, I guess, discuss the language of the motion, and then it's going to go into effect.
Right. Yeah. This is really horrible news and a dramatic escalation in the assault on, you know, LGBTQ rights here in Florida. You know, like I said, we talked on our last episode about all of the things that DeSantis and the Republicans in this state have been doing to attack women's rights and LGBTQ rights. And one of the things we mentioned is that trans people are sort of fleeing states like Texas and like Florida because of reactionary legislation like this that's being rolled out. So I kind of wanted to ask you, what would be the effect of this ban if it goes through? Would we see, you know, more of that? What would be the larger effect?
I think it's interesting you bring up the amount of trans people and trans families that are going to have to leave. When I was at the first committee hearing, we heard from a set of parents of a trans child that they're going to have to go somewhere else now to get care. They're going to have to go to a completely different state and potentially just move over there because it's literally not safe for them to raise their trans child here. So I think there's going to be an effect where people leave just because they have to get the care that they need, which, by the way, is not even, you know, that accessible to begin with. But then there's going to be this other effect that I know I am certainly concerned about, which is, you know, the state legislature and the state government. And now we're talking about, you know, the national legislature, right, is trying to impede themselves into the lives of trans people when they know nothing or next to nothing about the trans experience. And, you know, the Board of Medicine made that very clear that, you know, they know nothing about the trans experience. You know, there's no trans members on their board. You know, they were even having discussions about, you know, working with the state legislature for certain things, which, I mean, that is, you know, very concerning. And that really doesn't give any trans kids, trans people, families of trans people, that doesn't give them any kind of security or any kind of really incentive to stay here and try and get care for themselves or their family members, you know, when it's not even that accessible to begin with.
Right. Yeah. My understanding is that there is a lot of research and it is widely accepted that using puberty blockers and, you know, transition therapy is a good thing and that it is appropriate and medically necessary, especially for reducing the risk of suicide. You know, this is not just a thing here in America. It's widely accepted around the world. Surely the Florida Board of Medicine knows this, and surely people brought it up. What was sort of their reaction to this information?
Yeah, so I think there were some people who spoke at that meeting not even getting to the public comment, but there were some professionals who really had it down. Like they, you know, were on the side of trans kids. Like they knew that. And these are people that have been working with trans youth for like years, right? I think there's this assumption that, you know, it's just a one and done thing and it's over in like a couple weeks, when that's, I don't even know if that's ever happened. But these are people who have worked with trans kids for years and years and years. And usually there is a, how do I say it? There's usually like a expressed interest in going through these processes, because, you know, not everybody really wants to go through, you know, puberty blockers. Not everybody sees hormone therapy as what works best for them. And so, you know, when these professionals came up and spoke and they were saying, well, I don't give puberty blockers to people that I'm caring for if they don't tell me that they want it, right? So I definitely want to, you know, I guess kind of congratulate and hold space for the people who were there, who were, you know, speaking the truth, basically, as people who have worked with trans people before. I think the board didn't really see that, because there was this really... there was this really generalized discussion about how, well, if you are trans or if you're transitioning, there's only one process you go through and that looks the same for everybody, right? But, you know, we know that the trans experience is different for every single trans person, right? Like I said, there are some people who undergo hormone therapy. There are some people who don't. It doesn't make them any more or less trans than anybody else, especially at the opinion of the Board of Medicine, right? And so, you know, I had spoken to a few people who had a lot to say about that, and that it was like, you know, you can't constrain trans people in Florida to one or two different things and then ban based off that, because you're just hurting a bunch of people in the process.
You know, I'm glad you spoke about the people who were there and are professionals and did speak out in favor of, you know, trans minors who, you know, the Florida Board of Medicine doesn't seem to be letting them speak for themselves. And just this whole process of passing this clearly political decision. This isn't a medical decision. This is clearly a political decision. Like you said, there are members of that board who have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars to Ron DeSantis. This meeting took place 4 days before the midterms. This is clearly a political campaign trying to rack up reactionary wins for Ron DeSantis. But more than that, I want to talk about that process of public comment, right? How much public input was really allowed in this process, right? This is something that should have been done through a democratic process, but it wasn't. So the question is, how much was the public allowed to weigh in on what happened?
So in the committee hearing, it was a train wreck. So there was like only a handful of speakers, and the first 7 or 8 speakers were all people who were completely in support of this motion to ban the gender affirming care. And it's really like a double-edged sword in a very specific way, because all of these people who had spoken, or most of these people who had spoken, were people who transitioned and then detransitioned. And, you know, there were honestly a couple of people who were bringing religion into this. And they were like quoting the Bible, and they were talking about like, I met Jesus and now I know. And it was really weird. It was really weird how the, you know, board didn't really do anything to stop that. This is a Board of Medicine holding space for people who are droning on for 3 minutes about the Bible or whatever. But more than that, you know, most of these were people who weren't even living in the state of Florida. After these people had spoken, after this public comment section was over, we saw them leaving with suitcases. Like they weren't even living in the state of Florida. This one guy flew in from Germany, right? And they still let him speak. And it really wasn't fair for the people who had driven like 3 hours, 5 hours or more to get here when they live in Florida. And you know, after those folks had spoken, there were maybe a handful of people who were against the motion who actually got to speak. And during this committee hearing, which was, you know, 2 hours were allotted for public comment, they cut it off like halfway through and they started kicking people out. And, you know, there was a massive protest. We had a die-in. And by the way, one thing that was, I think, is really important to denote is that this committee meeting was held in an airport. It was held at Orlando International Airport in the hotel. Like, talk about inaccessibility, but, you know, I feel like that was a very intentional choice. Anyway, so that was a committee hearing, total train wreck. When we get to the general board hearing, a little bit more structure. However, this was in a Holiday Inn at Disney Springs. So even more weird. But, you know, they had designed it in a way where I believe 16 people were speaking, or like eight pairs were speaking, right? So eight people were speaking for the motion, eight people were speaking against it. And so I guess that gives you a little bit more, I guess if you wanted to hear both sides, now you can hear both sides equally. But even so, you know, nowhere near the amount of voices were heard that day for people who were against the motion. And again, when we talk about what happened at the second meeting, it was still a bunch of people who had, you know, detransitioned, and now they were supporting the motion, people quoting the Bible, people saying, is this what God would want? And they were still like, the board was eating this up. And, you know, it was just a very stressful experience, because you could tell that it was, you know, for lack of a better word, rigged, especially the first one. The second one, I guess they had like learned their lesson to not, you know, really, I guess, do that anymore. But, you know, it was just, it was really interesting, because I will say too that in regards to the people who had detransitioned, a lot of it was because, you know, they had made it clear that a lot of it was because they weren't in a supportive environment that helped them through their transition, right? And so there is like a certain level of empathy that I do have for those people who had spoken, because it was so clear that they had like this internalized transphobia, right? Because, you know, if you're transitioning really anywhere in the United States, really, but especially in the South, but if you're undergoing a transition under a system that's already working against you, I can see how you would very easily, you know, internalize transphobia. You know, after all of these public comment sections were done with, I was really talking with some people like, hey, these are not just some, you know, weird whack job people, right? Like, these are people who were and are hurting. And, you know, I really do think about them, and I hope they get the, I hope to get the help that they need. Like, you know, it's a very brutal system out here.
That was Harrison Lundy speaking to Ali Abdelkader of The Ruthless Truth from Pacifica affiliate WSLR in Sarasota, Florida.
Sometimes in our lives, we all have pain, we all have sorrow, but if we are wise, we know that there's always tomorrow. Lean on me when you're not strong, and I'll be your friend, I'll help. Just might have to lean on, lean on me.
That was the late, great Bill Withers, Lean on Me. You're listening to Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm Mikul Holt. In California, since October 31st, 2022, 130 long-term caregiver staff have been on a statewide strike. They are members of SEIU 2015, a merged local and one of the largest in the United States. These workers are on call for 24 hours a day, and they talked with Pacifica Steve Zeltzer about why they went on strike.
SEIU Local 2015 is a conglomerate local that was formed of a bunch of mergers between locals that handled long-term care here in California. So we work primarily with long-term home care, public sector workers, and also private nursing home, private agency home care, hospice workers, assisted livings, folks, anybody in the long-term care industry. We represent about 400,000 workers across California. Of course, that's not our membership number, but those are the folks on our public side and mixed with our private side that we have representational work towards. And yeah, we're the second largest local of SEIU in the country, the largest on the West Coast. And we're a big, big entity. We ended up out on our seventh day now of a strike because of unfair labor practice charges that occurred during a wage reopener bargaining that was happening between our staff union and our employer. And there are three charges. Our employer illegally declared impasse. They unilaterally implemented changes to our contract. And then they broke off communication with us and refused to communicate around bargaining. So we filed charges on them back in March, and we have been escalating, trying to get them back to the table. And here we are now, like I said, on our seventh day of our strike.
The kind of conditions, I know that workers under COVID, many of your members of 2015 are the frontline workers who've been living through really a hellish situation with PPE. And I mean, the stress, it must be tremendous for the workers of SEIU 2015.
Absolutely. I mean, many of them went through the toughest conditions, like you said, during the pandemic. I mean, the nursing homes were among the hardest hit. You know, nursing homes are already, you know, kind of a disaster industry and disaster workplaces. And you throw a pandemic on top of that, and, you know, things are going to go very badly. And they did, and they continue to. So, yeah, that also fell back on a lot of the staff. And we have been short staffed primarily in our nursing home sector, primarily here in the Bay Area where I'm at, you know, which is our highest density of nursing homes, you know, our private side for that. And we have among the fewest reps for that. So everybody felt the strain in some way or another due to the effects of and impacts of COVID.
You know, when it's when we fall into crisis and we have when management is disconnected with the realities of the work, they tend to drive the workers harder. And in our situation, we had three members die either while working because of the stress, or as one individual was on his way on vacation and died in transit, because the demands on the workers, on our workers, has been so so stressful, so demanding that we haven't been able to figure out how to cope. And we warn management over and over again that we need to get to the table, settle our contracts, settle our disputes in a, you know, we need to follow the discourse of the labor movement. We need to exemplify it. And it's fallen on deaf ears, and we've lost three people directly due to work-related stress. So the impact has been on us has been devastating to lose, to watch workers work themselves to death for something they truly believe in, and then not have that same commitment reciprocated by our management has been really discouraging and heartbreaking.
And we're talking about, you know, workers, I mean, who are trying to represent workers and under tremendous stress themselves. So it must be a traumatic situation to lose three of your own members because of the stress and overwork.
Yeah, I think going off what Manny was saying, I've been a syndicalist since, you know, I was a kid. Coming into this, I didn't know the amount of bureaucracy that there are in unions. And so I feel like this failure to speak with us goes deeper. Their failure to listen to us when we ask for, you know, more accessibility to benefits for members, more staffing, letting them know of the high turnover. And it always falls on deaf ears. I think this is something that has been brewing for a long time, and there's a lack of representatives, and a lot of it falls on members because they're so passionate about IHSS, about private agencies. You know, the bureaucracy in this union exploits that. It's really sad, and so I want to see a member-driven union, not a bureaucracy-driven one. That's why I'm in this.
Ultimately, what the members are asking for is that SEIU 2015 lives up to its values. It's really disheartening as someone who is new to the labor movement, see the people who are supposed to be leading us in this charge really violating a lot of the values that we hold so dear. It's insulting to a lot of us for them to be sending us emails asking for scabs and constantly using the same tactics that we're trained to go against, that we're trained to identify and teach other people to identify. And so ultimately, how are we supposed to tell our members that this is the place that you want to work for? This is the place that ultimately, being one of the lowest paying locals in the state, this is where you should stay. It's difficult to say that when the leadership isn't holding up to the values that we're supposed to be preaching.
And when we talk about hours, I mean, I know we've covered many struggles of union people. I mean, the fight for an 8-hour day. Do you have an 8-hour day in your local? I mean, the 8-hour day is a pretty strong demand in the labor movement not to have overwork. It seems like in your situation, you're really stressed out and overworked. Is that the reality for your members?
Yeah, I think most of us, and this was, you know, one of the things going into why we formed this staff union here, and also why, you know, our parent organization, Pacific Northwest Staff Union, was founded, was that, you know, there's this understanding or this norm or a culture within, you know, labor movement staff that we're supposed to be martyrs for the cause or something, and they just burn and churn people out constantly. So that the turnover rate, you know, the longevity for somebody who's an organizer is around 2 years, something like that, because you can't keep going at that speed or working those long hours, at a rate higher than 2 years. And so you're just in a constant, you know, churn of new folks coming in and out of here. And it's not sustainable. It's not how you build a long lasting and vitalized, labor movement. So our first day that we went out was actually halfway point through the day. So at 2:00, we sent a call out saying, you know, management is not here. We were in bargaining. Management is not here to be serious. They're stalling us is what they're doing. Hoping that they take the win, out of the sails of our strike. And they're not seriously engaging in the process. They're doing the same thing that they were doing, before, which led us to this. So we're out. 2:00, we're out. And by 3:30, the union was completely shut down. And they really didn't think that we could pull that off. And come Tuesday morning at 6 a.m, we had full picket lines up, you know, in our main headquarters in LA and in a location in Sacramento. And management reacted about as ugly as any company could.
And yeah, I've seen a video on Instagram. Apparently they tried to run over or nearly ran over one of your members. Why don't you talk about that? And I mean, it seems to be pretty shocking. Here you're in a union, your union staff, and this is how you're being treated. I mean, by union officials or scabs who are trying to break your strike.
Yeah. So the person who, you know, ran into their car into our line, and the video unfortunately starts about at the end of the incident, because all of us were scrambling, one, to get out of the way of the truck, and two, to actually get our phones out and videotape it. We had been running an active picket line, and we had been charged by several managers before this. So the executive vice president for the local actually charged his car into the line, you know, revved right up to it and came within a few inches of one of our members. And then we held him there on the line in spite of that. And then another management person who's actually the nursing home, one of the nursing home rep managers down there, she found a gap in our line and actually rode her Mustang like at full speed through there. And one of our members had to dodge out of the way. And then, yes, later on that evening, our HR person slowed down into our lines and then just accelerated right into us and pushed most of us out of the way, knocked most of us out of the way. Thankfully, nobody went down underneath her truck.
Those were members of Pacifica Northwest Staff Union Local 2015 who talked with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer about the conditions for home care and nursing workers and the physical attack on their picket lines with automobiles by the SEIU 2015 management with support from the president, April Everett, who is also secretary treasurer of the SEIU and controller of the California Democratic Party.
We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families.
I wanted more a pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis, prolonged long black lung disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived. We bring more than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. More than a paycheck to our loved ones and families. I wanted more than a pay, but what I've got here today is more than I bargained for. When I walk through that door, I bring home asbestosis and silicosis for round long black lung disease, and radiation hits the children before they've really been conceived.
We bring more than just a little paycheck. You're bringing more than a paycheck. I'm bringing more. You're bringing more than just a little paycheck.
That was Sweet Honey in the Rock, More Than a Paycheck. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akua Holt. On November 10th, at Raytheon Technologies in Arlington, Virginia, supporters of the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal served subpoenas on Raytheon and three other United States weapons manufacturers, charging them with war crimes, crimes against humanity, theft, and bribery. We now go to On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital, with producer and host Esther Everin for more.
War profiteering is obscene!
Turn around, make something green!
War profiteering is obscene!
Turn around, make something green!
War profiteering is obscene!
Turn around, make something green!
I'm a U.S. Army veteran, 29 years in the U.S. military, and 16 years as a U.S. diplomat. These merchants of death, such as Lockheed Martin that we're standing in front of, are the purveyors of death throughout the world. We as American citizens have the responsibility to call out when we see criminal acts being committed by companies and on behalf of the U.S. government, the warmongering U.S. government that has had so many wars around the world. So we as citizens are here to say no more death, stop these merchants of death, stop the huge expenditure that the United States makes on military weapons and on wars. So no more wars, no more merchants of death. Thank you.
Say no to Lockheed Martin!
Say no to Lockheed Martin!
Say no to war profiteers!
Say no to war profiteers!
Today, November 10th, 2022, the representatives of the Merchants of Death
War Crimes Tribunal delivered a subpoena to Lockheed Martin. They are charged with committing war crimes, crimes against humanity, bribery, and theft. They have 90 days to respond to our subpoena, and if they fail to do so, the tribunal moves to the second phase of its operations. The subpoena demands that they turn over all documentation evidencing their crime in the commission of war crimes, crimes against humanity, bribery, and theft. All of us have gathered here today in support of that. We've got Noam Chomsky and John Pilger and Cornell West and a wide assembly, and right this year, Medea Benjamin were here, all of whom are supportive of this effort. We simply seek to hold these people accountable. They're using United States tax dollars to manufacture weapons of death, and they're leaving a trail of suffering across the globe. And that is in Libya, in Iraq, in Somalia, Sudan, Afghanistan, Pakistan. We seek to stop it and say, not in our name anymore, and not with our dollars. So this tribunal is going to shine a light inside their corporate headquarters and reveal just how much money they are making off of death.
Say no to Lockheed Martin!
Say no to Lockheed Martin!
Say no to war profiteers!
Say no to war profiteers!
We're here outside the headquarters of Lockheed Martin, and this war in Ukraine has really been a greenwashing for these merchants of death, because it's being portrayed that they're helping the resistance in Ukraine, and so they are doing a very positive thing after they've been so outed for the death and destruction they've caused in other places like in Yemen. And I think it's important for people to recognize that what's happening is that this war is giving them a new lease on life after the war in Afghanistan ended, or the U.S. participation ended. And so they're now looking for a multi-year war against a powerful country. And there is an amendment now they're trying to put onto the National Defense Authorization Act that would allow for the contracts for the weapons companies to be multi-year contracts that don't have to be approved every year by Congress, and that would be no-bid contracts as well. And so this Ukraine war is something they want to see going on. I think it's important that we're here now outside these companies to say this war and every single war must end, and these companies must either go out of business or find something to do that is useful for humanity.
Do we know how much money Lockheed Martin is making off the war, or do we have any figures for these companies?
Well, we know that their stocks have soared as soon as the war started, and then as soon as this amendment was introduced, their stock soared, because this is exactly what they want. They don't want scrutiny by Congress, and they certainly don't want scrutiny by the American public. So I don't know exactly what they are right now, but we know that war is good for their business. War is their business. And this is what makes their millions of dollars in profits, when you look not only at these gigantic buildings that they have here, but look at the mansions all around here. And these mansions that you'll see in the Virginia countryside, all close to Washington, D.C., is money that came from death and destruction and suffering and violence. And, you know, that's their business.
How many kids have you killed today, Lockheed Martin?
That was Code Pink co-founder Medea Benjamin, and before her, activist Brad Wolf and retired Colonel Ann Wright, speaking Thursday morning outside the headquarters of weapons manufacturer Lockheed Martin in Crystal City, Virginia. That was the first stop in the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal, which serves subpoenas on Lockheed Martin and then Boeing, Raytheon, and General Atomics for war crimes. More about the campaign is at merchantsofdeath.org.
That was the voice of Esther Iverum, host and producer of On the Ground, Voices of Resistance from the Nation's Capital.
All I want to say is that they don't really care about us. All I want to say is that
That was the great Michael Jackson. They don't care about us. This is Pacifica's COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Akul Holt. In August of this year, the Centers for Disease Control updated their COVID guidelines to remove the distinction between vaccinated and unvaccinated people. Vaccine mandates nevertheless continue to be enforced for many workers. University of California Irvine professor and physician Dr. Aaron Cariotti was fired early this year after refusing to get the COVID vaccine since he had already had COVID and developed natural immunity. Dr. Cariotti filed a lawsuit in a federal court challenging the constitutionality of the university's vaccine mandate on behalf of COVID-recovered individuals. He discussed this recently on the Jimmy Dore Show.
So I spent 15 years as a professor in the School of Medicine at University of California, Irvine, where I also directed the medical ethics program. And I challenged their vaccine mandate in federal court back in August of 2021. And the university swiftly fired me after that. This was a lawsuit on behalf of people like me with natural immunity. And the latest on that is last month, the CDC finally caught up to the science and endorsed my central argument in the case, which is that we shouldn't discriminate between vaccinated and unvaccinated. First, because natural immunity is more robust than vaccination. And second, because these are not sterilizing vaccines. These vaccines don't prevent infection and transmission. So my case is actually still in the federal appellate court. We're just waiting for a judge to be assigned and for the case to be heard. But given that the CDC is now fully endorsing my position, I anticipate that the outcome of this case will hopefully go in my favor and set a precedent that there are limits to what the state can do in terms of mandating, you know, a novel therapy to be injected into people without informed consent.
So what do you mean by they don't have informed consent?
Well, so with a vaccine mandate, basically, if you're under a threat of losing your job, that constitutes a form of coercion. So, you know, legally informed consent means you have to be given accurate information about the vaccine, which was also not available in 2021 during the mass vaccination campaign. And second, you have to be able to make that decision freely to accept or decline that medical intervention. So even subtle forms of pressure or coercion would undermine informed consent when it comes to a research study or when it comes to consenting for a surgery or a medication. And these vaccine mandates obviously did an end run around that basic principle of medical ethics. The principle of informed consent is the central principle articulated in the Nuremberg Code, which was a response to Nazi atrocities, was a response to medicine in the Third Reich, where they experimented on people without their consent, often doing really horrifying experiments. And the world reacted very strongly to that, you know, 50 years ago after World War II. And somehow during the pandemic, we decided that it was okay to toss that principle, really the foundation of 20th century medical ethics, we decided it was okay to just toss that principle overboard and mandate not just a medical intervention, but a medical intervention that by our own federal government's definition was still experimental, that was authorized only for emergency use. And it was not a fully authorized product when these mandates were initiated.
Now, two big things have come out. One thing was that natural immunity was in the data from Pfizer.
Oh yeah,
but we knew that in the fall of 2021, correct? That Pfizer had found out that natural immunity was at least as good as the vaccine was, right? Correct.
That's right, and this should not have surprised anyone, Jimmy, because we've never had a vaccine that is superior to infection-induced immunity. That's what a vaccine is trying to imitate. You know, a vaccine, that's the gold standard. And a vaccine is trying to get as close to infection-induced or natural immunity as it can without causing severe symptoms. That's the whole concept behind a vaccine. So it should not have surprised anyone that natural immunity would be at least as good and possibly superior. And we now know that it's, in fact, superior to the immunity that you get from a vaccination.
So that would, it seems that that would be an unbelievably strong argument against mandatory vaccinations of someone who has already prove that they have the antibodies to the virus, because then they would have natural immunity. Now, natural immunity is a thing that has been going on since, I don't know, since the beginning of time. Why do you think doctors... Why do you think doctors during COVID forgot about it? Why did this happen during COVID?
No, it's very baffling, because this is really immunology 101. This is something that a first-year medical student should understand very clearly. But what happened during COVID was that public health authorities and people in positions of power, people at the NIH, for example, who are responsible for funding science, basically made it clear that they wanted a needle in every arm. And that any discussion of things like natural immunity or potential adverse effects of the vaccine was going to be forbidden. It's just not something that you could talk about publicly. So there was this, from the beginning, there was this lack of transparency and an attempt to control people's behavior by only giving information that we thought would encourage vaccination and never mentioning things, even true basic scientific facts that might discourage vaccination. And I mean, I talk about in my forthcoming book called The New Abnormal, I talk about this problem with transparency. The federal agency that approves medications and vaccines, the FDA, was required on the day that they approved the Pfizer vaccine to release all the clinical trials data. They didn't do that. So I, along with some fellow scientists, had to file a FOIA request, a Freedom of Information suit against the FDA to get that data released. The FDA came back and said, we'll give you 500 pages a month, which if you do the math, would have taken 75 years to release the data that they reviewed in 108 days. The FDA shockingly also requested that the company, Pfizer, be allowed to redact the data before it was release. The judge said no to both of those things and said, you've got to release it in the next 8 months. We've got a couple of months to go on that. So basically, we're still in a position, Jimmy, where thousands of people like me lost our jobs for declining a novel injection whose safety and efficacy data still remains hidden from full public scrutiny and full independent analysis, which should be concerning to Americans. This goes back to that issue of informed consent. You can't have informed consent if you're not informed, if you don't have all the information available.
That was Dr. Aaron Cariotti speaking on The Jimmy Dore Show. And that concludes today's edition of COVID, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the executive producers of CRD, Akul Holt, Paulina Vasiliev, and Steve Zeltzer. You can find this in all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD and on Facebook at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Akul Holt. Thanks for listening.